So the scene that Micah sets up in chapter 6 is kind of like a lover's quarrel. Oftentimes, Yahweh, the God of Israel, is depicted as Israel's husband. And Israel as God's bride, and they've come to a marital counselor, and they're sharing an argument with each other. Sometimes when you're having an argument with a spouse, someone might say, you're always out with your friends. You're never here with home with your kids. And the other partner goes, so what? I'm never allowed to go outside ever, right? I can't ever see my friends. I always have to stay here. You go 17 steps beyond with what was actually said. Israel does this with God, and so you all get to be Israel, and the Almighty will be played by Joshua.
Oh, my people, what have I done to you? In what have I wearied you? Answer me, for I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, and I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam.
With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with tens of thousands of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul?
He has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?
And from the Sermon on the Mount.
When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you."
Thank you so much. A couple of weeks ago, my wife Barb was visiting with an old friend of hers, the former parishioner, Joanne, whose husband, Roy, was dying. A few of you with Adamant connections might know Roy and Joanne. Roy was a funny, intelligent, caring, faithful man, a professor at Norwich. He'd had diabetes his whole life, and his body was finally wearing out from the struggle. He'd been in failing health for at least a few months, but now it looked as though it would only be a few days before he passed. So Barb was checking in with Joanne, calling her every few days, keeping track of Roy's status, asking how she was doing. And Joanne spoke of the hospice care, of their adult children coming home from the West Coast, from Australia, with their adult children, with their grandkids. She talked about the neighbors and the church friends who were stopping by and bringing meals and walking the dog and just sitting with her. And she said to Barb, "There's one word that keeps coming to mind, and that's blessed. I feel blessed." But then she paused and said, "Look, I don't want to sound super religious or anything, but that's how I feel, blessed." Even after Roy's death a couple of days later, Joanne was saying, "I continue to feel blessed. That's the only word I can think of to describe it." I don't think she meant blessed that she'd lost the love of her life. What she meant was she felt blessed by all the ways that people were caring for her. I think she meant she felt she was blessed by the way that Roy was able to die in exactly the way he wanted to, at home with family and friends nearby. I think she meant she was feeling blessed by the many years that they'd had together, the deep love they'd shared, even though she often spoke to Barb about how often they got on each other's nerves. That never happens in my house. I think she meant she felt blessed because right now, in these final days of Roy's life, all she had to do was show up and be with him. And she was surrounded by people who would take care of the rest. She said, "I feel like I'm being carried through this, like I'm blessed." "Blessed are those who mourn," Jesus said, "for they shall be comforted." Joanne was witness to that. All she could do at that point was open up and receive all the caring that faithful people around her tried to give her, and it was a great blessing. So what does this funny word mean? This super religious sounding word, blessed. What is the blessing that Jesus pronounced in the Beatitudes? What does he mean that the poor in spirit and the meek and the mourning and the persecuted are blessed, to make it really sound super religious or blessed? I don't think it means happy, and I have to say there's a number of modern translations that use that as the translation for, my brain just left. Thank you. Say it one more time. Marcario. I have it written right down here. There we go. That works. Happy are those who mourn? No, that doesn't make sense. And also, we know that in Luke's gospel, in his version of the Beatitudes, when he has blessings and the opposite that Jesus says is not unhappy are those who are rich, but rather cursed. So blessed means something else. But I'm not a Greek scholar, so I can't go into profound, deep stuff about that. So instead, Barb and I had a lot of conversation about this and trying to figure out, when have we felt blessed? And we decided we had a pretty long list, actually. But here's a completely ordinary, everyday, kind of boring example. When our son Micah was in high school, and some of them got their driver's licenses, they would just kind of tour around each other's homes and hang out for a little bit. So he and his buddies would descend upon our house for a few hours. It always felt like they were like a flock of Canada geese showing up. All noise and enthusiasm and laughter and everything else that comes with Canada geese. They were lanky boys, all elbows and knees and stinky shoes and wet jackets filling the entryway. Their long legs all tangled together at too many folks crowded around the dinner table or on the couch in front of the TV. Just doing their loud, energetic, adolescent thing, but feeling safe to be able to do that in our house. And they'd be there for a few hours, and they'd take off to somebody else's house and do it all over again. It felt like a blessing, especially when after they left, there was like this echo of their being there. Or maybe it was just the smell of shoes. But it was quiet in their absence, but their being there, that echo of their being there felt like a blessing.
Residual energy,
that's exactly what it was. Thank you, Don. The ordinary blessing of high school guy presence, the tender blessing of support for Joanne during Roy's death, all blessings really have something in common. Blessings are a gift bestowed upon you. We can't create them. We can't earn them. They are a gift. We don't make them happen. Which also is an important thing when we remember how we read this text. Because when I was growing up, this text was read as a series of admonitions. If you want to be blessed, be meek. If you want to be blessed, be a peacemaker. Actually, that one never got brought up. It was always the meek part when talking to us kids, I guess. That do these things and you will earn blessedness. And so I was always nervous. Am I being meek enough? And once you get there, you're like, hey, I was meek. Oh, darn, I messed it up. It's a gift. Jesus pronouncing it alone brings the blessedness. When he pronounces that, you are blessed. Now, we can put conditions together to help make blessings happen. We can build a network of friends. We can have a teen-friendly house. But the blessings come to us, unbidden. We don't make them. We can only receive them. And we can receive them with grace and thanksgiving or not. So I want you to think about it for a moment. 30 seconds. When have you felt blessed? Think of a time you have felt blessed. Was it something you made happen, or was it something you'd been given? Something you'd received? This might give us a clue about what Jesus is talking about in the so-called Beatitudes. Can't go through them all. I just want to take just a brief look at the first one here. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The word for spirit in Hebrew, you all know, is ruach, right? In Hebrew, it's depending on whether you're from Greece or not, pneumos or pneumos. It's the same word as breath and wind, spirit. And the word poor that Matthew uses here isn't just about money. It's about being bereft of any kind of social or self-support structures. Blessed are the poor in spirit basically means blessed are those bereft of breath. Or perhaps more accurately, blessed are those who have had the wind knocked out of them. And now you might say, Jesus, what on earth are you talking about? How can that be feeling blessed? I want you to think of a time where you have had a physical or emotional experience of having the wind knocked out of you. I suppose most of us can probably point to a time or two or three or 12. It happens literally when you fall off a mountain bike at high speed down a mountain, from what I've heard, or having a catastrophically bad date, or losing a job, or flunking out of a class, or realizing you have no idea how to raise a kid correctly. I don't ever recall feeling particularly blessed when any of those events happened to me. I remember feeling stunned. I remember wondering if I'd ever be able to breathe again. I remember gasping for that next breath and being awfully glad for air, whether it was physical or metaphysical. But the lesson is not how hungry I am for air. So when I've had the wind knocked out of me, physically or metaphorically, for that moment, I'm pretty helpless. I'm pretty vulnerable. There's no maintaining the illusion that I've got it all together. There's only the naked need for air or for help. And that, Jesus tells us, is precisely when blessing comes. When all there is the naked need for help. That's when I realize I have to depend on God. I have to depend on the kindness of strangers. I have to depend on the generosity of friends. I cannot ultimately depend on me. I'm going to have to receive whatever is given. I'm in need, desperate need of a blessing when I'm poor in spirit. I've had the wind knocked out of me. The blessing of air, the blessing of caring, the blessing of a helping hand. All I can do is receive it. There's nothing I can do to earn help when I've had the wind knocked out of me. Now, this sounds great in theory as long as it's happening to somebody else, right? I'm super okay with pronouncing blessing on the poor in spirit and the meek in the morning when it's somebody else. I'm not so big on being in a place of needing that blessing myself. That's what's so infuriating about what Jesus is up to with these Beatitudes. Because whether we like it or not, the truth is that no matter how we try to hide it or ignore it or put a mask over it, we are all vulnerable. All of us, to life with its ups and downs, to ill health, to accidents, to misfortune, to death. And we do all we can to avoid that vulnerability, of course. It's not fun, but it's still there. And when we accept it, we know that vulnerability opens us up to the fact that we're not ultimately in control. And even so, actually especially so, God loves us no matter what. We don't earn God's love. Gospel 101. We can only receive it as a blessing. But here's the thing, when we're spiritually mature enough to recognize our own vulnerability, is that it has to open us up then to recognize our deep spiritual connection to everyone else's vulnerabilities as well. We are connected to everyone else who is vulnerable too. And that would be everybody else in this messed up, broken, twisted little planet we call home. Everybody's broken. Everybody's vulnerable. Which is why I find the Beatitudes of Jesus to be both comforting and really unnerving. That list of blessed ares reminds me intimately of my own vulnerability. That's the unnerving part. And so the same blessed ares make it possible for me to live into my vulnerability without fear. I think I said that too fast because even I didn't follow myself. When I recognize my vulnerability in the Beatitudes, I know then I am blessed. And being blessed allows me to be fearless even in my vulnerability. Because God loves us. And love, 1 John says, perfect love casts out all fear. Things may not be easy or comfortable and certainly not in my control, but I am blessed, I am beloved, and others are blessed and beloved too. So if I truly believe what Jesus is saying in the Beatitudes, and I recognize the mutual vulnerability I have with everybody else, I realize there is really no difference between me and the Syrian refugee mother desperately trying to get her children somewhere safe. The only difference is that I happen to be on this side of an artificial border, and she's shut out on the other with the door slammed in her face. The Beatitudes don't let me dismiss her as illegal. The Beatitudes don't let me dismiss her as non-human. Because they remind me that my vulnerability and her vulnerability are linked intimately, because each of us is a blessed, beloved child of God. And the Beatitudes demand that I put my blessedness to work so that she can be blessed also. The Beatitudes don't let us dismiss anyone else. The Beatitudes don't allow me to dismiss those I disagree with theologically or politically. Even the ones who I'm angry about slamming the door shut. Even if I feel they're being reactive or even inhumane, but the Beatitudes don't let me dismiss, they don't let me live in fear, and they won't let me dehumanize those I disagree with. If my faith says I will not agree with how they are acting, I will oppose it. I'll just bring in my own editorial comment here. I'm not nearly as concerned about making America great again as I am making America good and making America kind. But I will not hate. That's one of the things that make me ready to turn Facebook off. Because on every side, all I'm seeing is dismissing the other as other. And anger, even righteous anger, turning into hate for the other. All of us on every side of every issue are God's children. And the Beatitudes demand that I put my blessedness to work so that others may be blessed, no matter who the other is. And when I try to understand just how that's supposed to happen, I turn to Micah chapter 6, verse 8. It's one of my favorites. Barb and I wrote it into our wedding vows. It's the reason our son is named Micah. What does the Lord require of you but just this? To do justice, to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. Everything else is commentary, to misquote our rabbi. To live out this verse, like the verses of the Beatitudes, requires a lot of vulnerability. It is only by recognizing my shared vulnerability with the oppressed and the marginalized sisters and brothers that I read about or I meet. It's only by recognizing my shared vulnerability with them that I have the courage and the strength to take on injustice. It requires a lot of vulnerability to commit to being kind and merciful, even to those who make me crazy. And walking humbly with God, well, that kind of speaks for itself. It has vulnerability built right into the humble part. But Micah 6:8 requires more than just vulnerability. It requires fearlessness too. It requires us to set aside all the scripts, all the cultural scripts that encourage us, you command us even, to be afraid of people who aren't like us. Knowing that I am beloved, blessed by God, even when things aren't going the way I want them to, gives me a fearlessness in the face of injustice, in the face of the status quo. And when I say me, I mean all y'all. I don't just mean me. I'll make this first person plural. We may be nervous today, but we don't have to live in fear. The news might make our knees or our fists shake, but we will stand up for justice. The New York Times might make us exquisitely uncomfortable, but we can show mercy that recognizes the humanity even of opponents. And somehow, walking humbly with God and walking humbly with a community of faith helps us figure out the right balance minute by minute by minute. And when we go off the rails, I pray we have someone near us to go, hey, this way. Justice, mercy, compassion, love. It's together as community that we become part of the broad spectrum of faithful humanity that is working to heal the brokenness of the world. It's not easy. It is blessed. We live in a challenging place. We who are Christian and American. We have dual citizenship in our nation, the United States, and in the kingdom of God. And sometimes those citizenships agree. More often, most of the time actually, they don't quite line up. Sometimes they're actively in conflict. Now, like my dad, who was a career naval officer and a good Baptist, I'm proud to be an American. Yet also like my dad, who was a career Navy officer and a good Baptist, he knows where his first citizenship lies, and it's with Jesus Christ. And like my dad, and like many people of faith, and many folks who struggle for a just, merciful, fair, clean, healthy planet and people, I have a lover's quarrel with my nation that is fueled by my Christian belief that all people deserve, simply because they are alive and beloved of God and children of God, all people deserve to live peacefully in what Martin Luther King called the beloved community. And when our nation's policies work in the other direction, I'm going to be on the side of love. I want to be on the side of love. I want to help build the beloved community. Now, all those wonderful words said, I haven't done enough. I have not done enough to be on the side of love. I have not done enough to be part of the beloved community or building it. I have not sought the blessings of my brothers and sisters enough. I have not reached out with comfort and mercy enough. I have not been willing to suffer persecution for righteousness enough. And I expect on the other side of death to be apologizing to God a lot when I die for the risks I failed to take for love because of fear or laziness or a lack of compassion. There's an anti-apartheid activist in South Africa, a white anti-apartheid activist, who said his greatest fear on coming before the judgment of God was God saying, "Where are your wounds? Was there nothing worth fighting for?" I hope in my deepest heart for all of us to be headed in the direction of love, in the direction of Jesus, walking with God humbly. I pray for the wisdom to know when and how to use our blessedness so that others can be blessed in their need. In small ways and big ways, I pray we can be agents of justice. I hope we can show mercy. I hope we can all walk humbly with God. And I pray that we don't have to do it alone, that we do this together with others of faith and good heart. I believe that God is putting all this together into one big, kind of messy and entirely redemptive revolution, a revolution of love. Part of that walking humbly thing is being open to God's leading day by day. So I'm going to leave you with this quote from Roland Walls, who's the founder of a monastic community in Scotland. He wrote this: "Looking for the will of God and following Jesus are the same thing. And to follow Jesus is to walk step by step, not knowing what may be asked of you in the next quarter of an hour. There is no book, not even the Sermon on the Mount itself, on which you can rely to tell you exactly what you must do in any given moment. You have to keep your eyes wide open to discern that somehow the way before you is a way of love. That is an exciting and exacting and exhausting way to live because you never know what is going to turn up. But there is something marvelous in the fact that God's will for you in the next moment comes each time as a gift." And I would add, as a blessing.